The question I'm keen that we explore is, can we transform unjust structures? Because I've kind of picked up this morning a sense that I get in other places, a narrative that the structures are so huge and so unjust, and the system and politics is so broken, that what's the point? So can we actually transform unjust structures? What is the point? Why and how? And we're going to do all that in 20 minutes. So, Steph's a trustee of Church Action on Property, but also an activist, campaigner and author in your own right. Why are you wanting to transform unjust structures?
I think I come at it from two positions. One is from a Christian background. So when I see poverty and injustice, and you think how God responded to it, which was he sent his son Jesus to rescue us from our own sin, that level of grace should be shown to everyone, and that level of support that God offers us. So there's the theological perspective. As a Christian, we should be helping the poor, and it's not just through individual charity, but actually when you look at how God helped his nation, he did it through laws that he gave them about how they should run their economy. When he sent his prophets to judge Israel or the pagan nations, he talked to them about their oppression and injustice. So we know that God cares about not just Christians doing individual charity, but that we actually get the structures of society right. And then my other perspective is, as a disabled person, I became ill shortly after finishing university. I'd started studying for a PhD, but became ill, had to take leave, found that I couldn't get any benefits because I was registered as a full-time student, so I couldn't get ESA. But because I was on leave, I wasn't getting any PhD money, so I literally couldn't get anything. I had to go back, live with my parents. I didn't recover. It turned out to be a genetic condition. But because I was then ill and looking at the benefit system, and this was early 2012, I came across a group of disabled researchers who were looking into the problems that the Conservative governments were creating, and sort of fell into doing work with them. So since then I've been doing work, initially analysing the problems of what the government was doing, more recently starting to look at solutions. Because when you do get a big enough group of people who have the same experience of something, not everyone will have ideas of solutions, but some people will have some ideas. And if you talk about it together and put those ideas together, you can come up with suggestions for new policy. And you don't have to address the entire welfare system in one go. You can do one bit at a time. So we've done work on personal independence payment. You can do that as a discrete policy, or ESA as a discrete policy, universal credit, social care. If you've got a particular expertise in one area, you can make that your topic that you study and you find out more about, and then other people can be looking at something else. So no one person has to know everything. But if we each have something that we are particularly passionate and know about and do research on and work with others, then collectively we have something that you can then present to members of the public, to councillors, to MPs, to the government as a whole, and say, actually, there are different ways of doing it. Because one thing I found, particularly with the disability issues, is that the government or the opposition would turn back to you and say, but no one knows what to do. What are we going to do? So you do need to have some solutions, and by working together, you can, generally, I found, people do have ideas. You can find solutions, and you can put them to the people in charge.
And you got a book coming out?
Yes. So based off all the work I've been doing, I've found that there have been some common issues when I talk about this that I want people to know. So one of them is, there's a major problem with the disability benefit system. People know about universal credit now. If you say to someone, I work in welfare, they're like, oh yeah, universal credit's terrible. And I'm going, yes, but what about all the disability stuff that's been terrible for years before universal credit? You don't know about it, but you really, really should, because what bothers people about universal credit is it affects the in-work families when they're going, these are the deserving people because they're hardworking. But at the same time, they're in work, they can work. But for disabled people who aren't able to work, like I literally do about 2 hours a week, we don't have any alternative if the government cuts our money. We can't just go out and get more work. So there's a vulnerability for disabled people isn't quite the same for people in work. It's just a bit more severe, but people aren't aware of that. So I've wanted to be spreading that message. But also, when I talk to people from a more right-wing perspective, they tend to have assumptions of welfare dependency, that if you let the market rule, that will be fine. You just need to give people information and choice, and then everything will be fine. And they tend to believe that the problems we see in society of family breakdown or low education or drug abuse or being in gangs or low aspirations, they assume that those things cause poverty, and therefore to solve poverty you address those issues of people's attitudes and behaviour. But the research is that it's the other way around. If you're in poverty, that stress, the drain it puts on your cognitive capacities, that all reduces your ability to plan the rest of your life. It reduces your ability to parent consistently, to always buy and cook healthy food, to always attend work promptly and be really diligent whilst you're there, because you've got this background worry going on in the back of your mind, and then that stress feeds into your relationships. So you can actually, if you can explain to someone from the more right wing, we get that your concern is, for example, family values. You want people to be supported to be in good families. You think you do that by taking away their benefits so that they have to go to work and then they'll be good, upright people. But actually what you're doing is you're making their life even harder. You're putting them under stress and strain so that they can't do what you want them to do. But it turns out if you give them money, they spend less on alcohol, less on drugs, more on the healthy food, more on training courses if they want to train to upskill. Actually, it turns out poverty is about money, not about everything else. And I think what I've done with the book, hopefully, is I've tried to have in mind my conservative Christian friends and think, what would they say and what do they need to know? So that's what I've aimed it as. It's a history of the welfare state for disabled people with an explanation of how we got to where we are, particularly looking at neoliberal and welfare dependency myths. And then at the end, I'm bringing in some suggestions for what we should do instead.
What's it called?
Oh, it's called Second Class Citizens. It should be out very soon. I tried to get my editor to make sure it was out for this conference, but he was away and various other people were away. So he tells me it's just days away now for it to be out, but we'll see when it happens.
And we can make sure through Chris that the details of the book go out. So what would your aspiration be for more just structures, if we could ever have them?
Like the detail of what they should look like.
Well, not in the kind of detail, but how would you see them being different in a more general sense?
I think we need to get away from the welfare dependency myth, and I think we instead need to move towards an understanding that if we want people to have opportunities, the state has to provide it. So that was another of the conservative story lines, is we want equality of opportunity. So you need to know how you get equality of opportunity. And we've seen it on that video just now when the girls were saying the state should be there for us, it should be providing. And it's come up, I think, in conversations today. There are things the state has to do if people are going to have the options to do what the state wants them to do, which is to have stable relationships and have a career and be able to work and provide for themselves and their family, then the state needs to make sure that children can get a good education, which means the state needs to make sure there are good schools for everyone. And they really need to make sure there's enough jobs for everyone. Before the 1970s, after World War II, we had a policy of full employment. The government considered it to be a duty to make sure there were enough jobs for everyone, because you can't go out to work if there isn't a job. And we've lost that understanding. We've instead switched to blaming unemployed people. And we think if we can change the characteristics of the unemployed, suddenly there'll be jobs for them to go to. It doesn't work. So we need to make sure there's enough jobs. And we know we need to make sure there's enough houses, because if you can't live in a healthy house that you can afford to run near a job, you're going to be spending time and energy on things that you shouldn't have to be spending time and energy on. Same with public transport, that needs to be working. And you need to talk to communities about what they want. When I was on the table with Sue earlier, she was talking about her community. They'd recently lost the bus service that would go like in a loop round, picking up all the elderly people, dropping them off in the town centre for their shopping in the health centre. You need to talk to the specific community and say, what bus services or what transport services do you want and you need, and then provide them, even if they're not profitable. You need a health service that is adequately funded. So at the moment, we've got some of the London trusts are saying, we're only going to let our patients be under one consultant at a time. But we've actually got a problem in society of increasing multi-morbidity. People have more than one condition. You actually need to be under multiple consultants, often at the same time, so you can all work together. But because the NHS hasn't got the money, it can't do that. But if you don't treat people, then they can't recover and live the lives that you want people to have. So I think fundamentally, the state needs to go back to like the UN Human Rights Declarations and what they say about what people should have access to. And the state needs to realise that it is responsible for making sure that everyone has access to those things.
So a lot of that's about kind of national, which can still be quite large, but you've also just recently joined the Manchester Poverty Truth Commission.
Yes.
So you'll be spending the next year in a room with decision makers and kind of key movers and shakers in Manchester. What's your kind of aspiration for Manchester Poverty Truth Commission?
So that is, that's one of the key things that I think the church as a whole also has the unique position of being able to do, is that when you've got the church and related organisations, you've got a body that's got influence in society that people respect. And if therefore the church can get with the people who are experiencing poverty or other issues, the church can bring those people to the politicians and other people of influence. So that's what the Poverty Truth Commission does. It brings 15 people who are in poverty or experiencing poverty, and it puts them with 15 business and civic leaders who've got influence, so that together they can look at the issues and the policies of the local area and how to address them, and what it is that the council is doing that is actually a barrier. So in our first meeting, we had a lady called Jane from the Salford Commission. And one of the things they had done was they'd got the council to change the envelopes. So instead of using brown envelopes for council communications, which the DWP uses, they now use white envelopes. Because when most of your brown envelopes are from the DWP, it's really scary, because you're getting letters in going, you need to come in for assessment, or you had an assessment and we disagreed, or we reconsidered your assessment and we still disagreed. And you don't need many negative letters to be scared of all of them. And I know, and that's one of the things that I have, because I'm predominantly on benefits, is it's scary every time a brown envelope comes in. So actually it's really nice that the council uses white ones, because you're not scared every time you look at your letterbox.
And that idea came from one of the grassroots commissioners.
Yes, because that was something the council would never have thought of. They probably quite like the brown ones because they're cheaper and they're recyclable and so on, and because they've not been bleached. But so there's little things like that that can make quite a bit of difference. I think another one they had was pointing out to the council that actually if someone was in arrears and the bailiffs were sent in, that was often the very first time someone had any human contact when they were in arrears, because it was all done by letter. So there's little things like that which you can do just to make processes better and more human, so that you actually talk to someone, which can help change the council from being an obstacle to being a support. My personal hope is that we will be able to introduce something, or a version of a job guarantee. So a large-scale job guarantee would be the government, instead of paying people to look for work that doesn't exist, it pays people a living wage to do something useful for society. So it might be maintain the park, it might be do some gardening for a disabled person, it might be run a community cafe or teach someone about your hobbies or local history lessons, anything that the community wants. And what I'm going to suggest to the council is that, at least initially, we can do this as a way for people to pay council tax or council tax arrears, or for homeless people to pay for services, so that we can trial it and, I guess, get through some of the teething problems of how you administer such a programme. Because that's something that, if it works and you can scale it up to the country, you can give people the option of having the dignity of good work, which then has ramifications for the rest of society and the economy. So sometimes, if you want big change, you don't have to get there in one jump, and you don't have to have the ideas now. You can start small and just find other people to talk to and bounce ideas around, and eventually someone, like between you, someone somewhere will have an idea that they want to test. And that's when you, if you then have something like the church or Church Action on Poverty or another group that can get you in with the politicians, so that you can then develop it as a policy, then that's when you can start seeing some change.
So if I could take that on to one of my roles now, is I'm chairing a national campaign to end hunger in the UK, which is a kind of little goal that we've set. Working with a whole set of other partners, Trussell Trust, Oxfam and others, based around a positive vision of a UK where everyone has access to good food and no one needs to go to bed hungry. And that's deliberately a positive vision, and it's deliberately framed as one, who in this room? Anyone in this room disagree with that as a vision? Just checking you're awake. Anyone want to stick your hand up? But would anybody in this country actually seriously disagree with a vision of a country where everyone has access to good food and no one needs to go to bed hungry? And our goal, which we're kind of more crystallising that, is to say, to realise that, government needs to step up to the plate and commit to taking some action. And before that, it simply needs to recognise that it's got a role to play. And then to take some concrete action. And people might think I'm bonkers to think that that's a realistic goal to achieve in the next 2 years. And my grounds for having confidence is a group in Leeds called the Leeds Food Aid Network. When we were doing work on Universal Credit last year, took on to go and see six of their local MPs. Two of whom were Conservative MPs, one called Alex Shelbrook, and I told a colleague in Oxfam that they're going to go and see Alex Shelbrook, and the colleague at Oxfam laughed and said, what on earth is the point in going to see him? He's a right-wing Tory. He really, waste of time. Four people went to see Alex Shelbrook, including at least one who is a constituent. They shared stories of the impact of Universal Credit on his constituents. Why? Because there were specific issues with Universal Credit for these people. They were going hungry. They had a welfare benefits advisor that gave the detail of which bits of the policy weren't working. As a result of that meeting, Alex Shelbrook and his other Tory colleague from Leeds personally went to see the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions to say, well, what we don't know what he went to say, but he went to have a meeting about that issue. That was during autumn last year, where the government put £1.9 billion back into Universal Credit. So for me, that point of that story is a small group of people with a powerful, well-researched case taking on a right-wing Tory can actually get them on board. The challenge for all of us is to have the belief that we can make change happen. But that is the only thing that ever has. And as Steph said, the church has got this massive capability to be a catalyst for change, if we believe that we can. There's a lovely story, which is not in this context at all, from Desmond Tutu. In the height of apartheid, had a protest in Cape Town, and the police banned it. So he went into the cathedral, turned it into a service, but basically preached exactly what he would have said outside. And the police came in to the cathedral and lined the inside of the cathedral, kind of intimidating tactics. And Desmond Tutu's response was to say, do you know you have already lost? Come and join the winning side. I think fundamental change is not treating our enemies as our enemies, but as fellow human beings. And Jacob Rees-Mogg is made in the image and likeness of God and has the capacity to change. Our challenge, if we're going to transform unjust structures, is to see the potential for change in any structure and in any person, and to get them in the space with people that actually understand the truth and the reality to make the change a reality for them.